Is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of the Chancellor, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at www.ccfd.uiuc.edu.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Early in the 20th century, an American psychiatrist believed he had found the cause of mental illness. Dr. Henry Cotton thought mental illness was caused by hidden infection in the body. To eliminate these infections, he performed surgeries on thousands of people. Many died, others were maimed. On the program today, we'll hear about Cotton, who was the superintendent of the Trenton State Hospital in New Jersey, and how it was that he was able to wreak so much death and injury. Our guest is Andrew Scull. He is the author of Madhouse, a tragic tale of megalomania and modern medicine. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Andrew Scull is distinguished professor of sociology and science studies at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of several books about the history of psychiatry, psychiatric doctors, and psychiatric hospitals, including Masters of Bedlam. His new book, Madhouse, is published by Yale University Press. Professor Scull, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, thank you very much for having me on the program.
Yes. Well, Dr. Henry Cotton was practicing psychiatry early in the 20th century. How were the mentally ill cared for at the time?
They were predominantly, if they were seriously mentally ill, sent to state hospitals. That's where the overwhelming bulk of them were to be found. And their care was largely custodial. By the late 19th century, psychiatry had begun to despair of its ability to cure patients, and it had responded by claiming that this was an incurable, often hereditary condition, and that that explained their failure. So it meant the hospitals basically provided continuing care for patients. A number of them were released, of course, from time to time. I don't mean to imply once in, you were always there, but many patients stayed for years and years.
Hmm. Now, Cotton, you say, did not hold with the pessimism of the day. What led him to psychiatry? What was his view of what was to be done with those who were mentally ill?
Well, Cotton shared the sense that mental illness was a biologically produced condition. He had trained under Adolf Meyer, who was the leading American psychiatrist of the first half of the 20th century, and he'd also trained in Germany under people like Alzheimer and Kraepelin. He was determined to find the medical causes of mental illness as a step towards effective treatment, and he spent a number of years on the chase. And then in the middle teens, he happened upon an idea which was quite widespread in American medicine more broadly at that time. This was the period when bacterial models of disease had come into broad acceptance in the profession after a number of years of skepticism, and they'd also, the idea of germs as the cause of disease had also become very much fixed in the popular mind. And the issue was why certain diseases did not seem to yield up their secrets did not seem to lend themselves to this kind of model of causation. And we're not talking just about psychiatric illness here. For example, conditions like arthritis and rheumatism were explained in a rather similar way in these early years of the 20th century. And the basic notion that Cotton borrowed was that hidden reservoirs of infection lurking unnoticed in corners and crevices of the body gave off toxins or poisons into the lymph, into the bloodstream. And in the case of mental illness, those poisons accumulated in the brain, producing the mental symptoms. So the symptoms of mental illness were just that. They were, in a way, just noise. There wasn't any meaning to them other than the fact that they revealed this toxic process. And since this was a period before the advent of antibiotics, you had no penicillins, no magic potions of that sort, the way forward, as Cotton saw it, was to practice what he called surgical bacteriology. In other words, if you couldn't medically treat the infection, you had to go in and cut it out.
Mm. And where in the body did these hidden poisons lurk?
Well, in 1916, when Cotton first launched down this path, he was convinced that the teeth were the most likely source of infection. They were adjacent to the brain, obviously, and poisons from infected gums could easily migrate there, or so he thought. In addition, many patients he treated, of course, turned out to have infected teeth that had been neglected. So his first course of action was to remove teeth. And when that didn't work, to move on to tonsils, because, again, there were many patients with infected tonsils. At that point, when there had been a handful of people recover and many who had not, he could have abandoned the theory. But instead, his rationale was as follows, that if these surgical interventions didn't suffice, it must be because of one of two things. Either the brain had become so thoroughly poisoned and damaged that the interventions were occurring too late, the structural damage was too extensive, or, and this was the unfortunate turn of events for many of his patients, there must be other kinds of infection that extended beyond the mouth, beyond the teeth and the tonsils. And, of course, he gathered the idea that since there were bacteria in the mouth, these would be swallowed, so the alimentary canal in particular became the source of his attention. Now, one of the things to bear in mind is the early 20th century is also the period when medicine as a whole is beginning to become more scientized, more involved with the laboratory, more involved with causes of disease that are not visible to the unaided naked eye. So x-rays, laboratory examination through microscopes of bodily fluids, of blood, and so forth, interventions using endoscopic tubes to go down into the stomach to inspect the stomach's contents, or barium enemas to look at what was going on in the lower gut. All of these were things that Cotton used in an effort to demonstrate that there were infections. And once he thought he detected infections, he was very aggressive at going in with the help initially of outside consultants and trying to remove them.
Hmm. Had he any training in surgery?
No, he did not, beyond the standard small amount of training he would have obtained in medical school. And when he began the abdominal surgery, which involved the removal of stomachs, of spleens, of colons, of the uterus in the case of his female patients, he used outside consultants in the first instance. But he assisted with the operations. As he became more confident, he began to do them himself. And when his major gastroenterological surgeon died, Cotton simply took over the surgery himself.
Wow. This is truly frightening.
It was very frightening because you had some thousands of patients in the hospital and obviously hundreds coming in each year. They had been involuntarily committed, which meant they'd lost their civil rights. There was no notion of informed consent, no check really on what happened in the hospital. And Cotton was free to pursue his theories, and he was quite open, even in the medical literature. He would boast of proceeding to do the surgery, even in the face of objections from the patients or the patients' families. And the rationale here was the traditional paternalistic one that the doctor knew best. When the patients objected, or the patient's families objected. That was an objection, he said, founded on imperfect knowledge. It threatened his cure rate, and he simply wasn't willing to abide by it. So as later emerged, patients would be muscled into the operating theater, if necessary, dragged kicking and screaming, and put under anesthesia, and the surgery would proceed.
Hmm. What did he claim as a cure rate?
His claimed cure rates in the literature ranged as high as 85%, which one might think was such an extravagant claim that it would have discredited him on the spot, but unfortunately did no such thing. People flocked from not just New Jersey. Of course, many of the patients in the New Jersey hospital had been committed involuntarily, but one of the striking things is as the Cotton's claims about miracle cures made it into the newspapers, made it into the medical journals. Patients' families started clamoring for these cures, and patients came from very large distances, from out of state, private patients, some cases volunteering themselves, more often volunteered by their relations who otherwise saw themselves as facing a prospect of mental darkness, of the patients being sent off to the backwards to rot.
Mm.
So patients really, even from very highly educated and wealthy and prominent circles, arrived in New Jersey to get Henry Cotton's attention.
Yeah. One of the patients that you write about by name was a woman by the name of Mrs. Llewellyn, and you call her a fortunate patient. Because she survived, but she was not fortunate in that she had to go through so many surgeries.
Absolutely. Fortunate should be tinged, certainly, with a great deal of irony here.
Yeah.
I should say at once that with the exception of patients whose identity became known at the time through newspaper articles and so on, whenever a patient name appears in the book, I've kept the proper initials, but I've changed the name.
Okay.
I did not want to add to the distress of families. And, in fact, I've been contacted by one or two families whose ancestors died under this regime. Yes, the problem for Cotton, of course, as I've suggested, was that failure didn't, in his eyes, cast any doubt on the theory at all. It simply meant that he had to go in and find other sites. So sometimes patients had as many as three or four or even five rounds of surgery. They very often, if they survived the first one or two, of course, succumbed the next time around. You had thousands of patients in the hospital who were bereft of all their teeth and weren't supplied with dentures. So mental hospital food in this period was pretty awful anyway, but if you couldn't chew, you can imagine the nutritional problems as well as the other problems that arose. And, of course, as people were steadily eviscerated, the health problems that caused were often quite massive. So, yes, fortunate is perhaps an unfortunate term in that sense. But it was meant as a kind of
yes.
Tongue-in-cheek, obviously.
I know.
Remark, yeah.
What was the mortality rate for these surgeries?
Again, this is a very remarkable thing. Once Cotton, not every patient, of course, proceeded to the abdominal surgery, but for those who did, Cotton, in print, reported that his mortality rate was of the order of 30%. In other words, 30% of the patients who got this surgery died either on the operating table or within a short time thereafter of complications from the surgery. In reality, subsequent studies showed that the mortality rate was almost 45%, so, not far off one in two. But the interesting thing, and the shocking thing in lots of ways, is that even multiple reports in the literature with Cotton's name on them saying he was killing one in three of his patients did not seem to provoke a backlash from his colleagues. There was a little muttering behind the scenes from some of them, but nobody in print, with one very minor exception that I can recall, said, this is intolerable, this must stop, this is a slaughter. And so, quite remarkably, he was allowed to continue, and he began this process in 1916, and his own involvement didn't end until his premature death in 1933. So this extended over a very, very long time.
Yeah. He was an ambitious man, so he promoted himself and his theory and his idea of cure, didn't he?
Very much so, and he met with a great deal of success, and it was a success not confined to the United States. He was twice invited to visit Great Britain and deliver lectures, and he was lionized over there as late as 1927 by the president of the Royal College of Surgeons over there, by a number of Britain's most prominent doctors, as a new Lord Lister. Lister was the man in the last third of the 19th century who revolutionized surgery by importing the notion of antisepsis, or the need to avoid infection in surgical wounds. And just as Lister had revolutionized surgery, so these prominent British doctors and a number of American counterparts thought Cotton was on the brink of revolutionizing psychiatry. Part of the attraction there for them was that this was a thoroughly medical kind of approach to mental disease. This was the period when, of course, the doctrines of psychoanalysis and Sigmund Freud were beginning to come to the fore, and many, many doctors were made very uncomfortable by Freud's ideas, saw them as quackery, as something that didn't belong in medicine. So to have somebody who had a theory of mental illness which tied things very thoroughly back into the thematic side of things was something that appealed very much to Cotton's professional audience, I think. Mm.
So then other hospitals in the U.S. and abroad, they took up Cotton's methods?
They did. I think it's clear that the abdominal surgery that Cotton practiced was something, perhaps to their regret, that many other mental hospital superintendents couldn't do. It took more resources than they had. But the treatment of infected sinuses, of teeth, of tonsils, that was done everywhere. In Britain, for example, there was a physician with the perhaps unfortunate name and under the circumstances of Thomas Chivers Graves. And Dr. Graves was every bit as enthusiastic for focal sepsis as Cotton. And he brought Cotton to his hospital, and Cotton there witnessed Graves pulling teeth from his patients without anesthesia, something even Cotton didn't do. And Graves ran those hospitals, all the hospitals in the center of England, until 1950, and continued pulling the teeth all until that time. Mm-hmm. And even after Cotton's death at Trenton, the people who succeeded him all the way down until 1960 were his protégés, continued to proclaim that they believed in focal sepsis, stopped doing the abdominal surgery, I think, because of the frightful mortality, but continued to do, for example, the teeth extractions. I spoke with the dentist who practiced at the hospital from 1918 to 1960, and he pulled literally hundreds of thousands of teeth in that period. And when I spoke with him, was still convinced that Cotton's ideas were correct and that someday he'd be seen as a genius. And that was a very uncomfortable interview for me as a scholar, talking to somebody who still, after all those years, you know, thought he'd been on the right track and doing the right thing, and in fact had maimed, as I say, thousands and thousands of people.
So Cotton dies in 33, but the teeth are still being extracted, and tonsils, I would imagine, as well, as late as 1960 at Trenton?
Yes, that's correct. And Trenton, in its annual reports to mental hospitals, typically put out a report, or in those days used to put out a report annually. And all through the 50s, that report had a kind of ritual phrase that we continue to believe that focal sepsis is a prominent cause of mental illness, and we treat the patients accordingly. And indeed, they did.
Mm. One of those visits that Cotton made to Europe was at the invitation of Graves. He went to London to deliver an address to a medical association in 1923. And you write in the book, the attentive listener would have said, "Wait a minute. Why weren't people paying attention? How did this happen?"
One thing I think that's important to realize is that in medicine in the early 20th century, the notion that one should trust one's fellow practitioners when they made claims was quite widely held. I think few people could really believe that Cotton would continue doing these things if there wasn't something to the notion. And there were very, you know, it turns out that the internal controls within the profession were extraordinarily weak. It's not that nobody disputed Cotton's claims. In fact, there was a growing controversy in the mid-1920s about his work. There were there was a team at Columbia, for example, that had tried to replicate his findings and had actually run a kind of crude control group, that is, a group of patients who were treated with surgery and another group who were not. It wasn't a blind trial as we would want now, or a randomly assigned group of patients, but they tried that and reported that the Cotton's treatments appeared to be absolutely useless. Cotton's response to that, and it was one that many of his fellow professionals didn't dissent from, was that these people simply had not been ruthless enough. They had only skimmed the surface, as it were, of the infections, and that was why they hadn't been able to cure. And as I say, there were just many people, including Cotton's mentor, Adolf Meyer, who found this notion intriguing and attractive. Meyer was somebody who believed in the multiple causation of mental illness, but nonetheless, he was very, very keen to track down the possible biological roots of the problem, and he was willing, therefore, to see this experiment proceed to see what the results would be. And the fact that patients were being damaged in the process really did not seem to trouble many in the profession. I wouldn't say there were not some who weren't troubled, but there were very many who were willing to have this happen. More broadly, Cotton's approach appealed to some very long-standing folk beliefs about health and illness that we can trace back in the Western world a very, very long way. The idea that internal cleanliness is connected to health, that regularity of bowel movements may have some contribution to keeping you healthy, was one that had a very, very long history. And one of Cotton's supporters, for example, was John Harvey Kellogg, a name you'll know if mm-hmm. you eat your breakfast cereal. Kellogg was actually himself a physician who ran a sanitarium, a home for the nervous, in Battle Creek, Michigan. And he, too, believed in a connection between fecal contamination through the bowel and all sorts of ill health. And so Cotton's ideas, for example, appealed very much to him and to the thousands and thousands of people out in America who thought that the Kellogg way was the way to health.
Yeah. One of his critics, one of Cotton's critics, was a psychiatrist by the name of J.K. Hall. Although you quote from correspondence in the book to, I believe, to, was it a nephew or?
Yes, it was Hall's nephew, I think.
Yes, Albert Anderson. And he wrote to his nephew, quote, "Cotton's theory and work is doing some good, but in my opinion, it is doing more harm." And one of the questions that this sort of raised when I was reading it is, did Cotton have become a star in a sense, and did his status then lead to a reluctance on the part of colleagues of criticizing him? And, you know, were people fearful of saying the king has no clothes
right.
on?
I think they were very fearful about bringing down public mistrust of psychiatry. When Hall there refers to Cotton doing some good, the good I think he's talking about is that Cotton's ideas gave patients and their families some hope, and from the profession's point of view, did some good in the sense that it presented the idea that the psychiatric profession was open to new ideas, was trying to join the mainstream of medicine, was becoming more scientific. So certainly that's part. People were afraid of Cotton because he certainly was a very intimidating and belligerent man, so that in person arguing with him was a formidable experience, I think. But beyond that, yes, the other thing is that Cotton had better scientific credentials than most of the profession at the time. He had trained, for example, in Germany, which was something only the elite of the medical profession did in this era, and German medicine was seen as in the forefront. He trained under Meyer. In those ways, had become a professional star, and then in the public mind, he'd become a quite prominent figure. There were newspaper articles about him and his treatment. When he lectured at Princeton University, he gave a very distinguished lecture series, which was later graced by people like Linus Pauling and Robert Oppenheimer. So he had all the weight of that kind of thing. And those lectures were reviewed in the New York Times, and Cotton was hailed in its pages as a remarkable pioneer. So, yes, he did have the kind of clout that comes from that sort of prominence. And as I say, his own demeanor was very, very combative and fierce, and many of his colleagues seemed to have shrunk from challenging him.
Mm. So, too, apparently, Dr. Meyer.
Including Dr. Meyer, which is very interesting. Meyer was a Swiss-German who trained in Europe, come to America in the early 1890s, risen to prominence, was appointed in the early 20th century as the first professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins, which was the most important medical school in America in those years. And Meyer was notoriously an intimidating and frightening figure. One of his colleagues once said, Meyer trained most of the leading American psychiatrists in this age, and they all went on to careers elsewhere. And Smith Eli Jelliffe said that Meyer had put partly castrated pupils in the departments of psychiatry all over the country. That was usually Meyer's impact on people. They were frightened by his Teutonic manner, by his sternness, by his European education. But Cotton wasn't. And in fact, when he and Meyer faced off, it was always the older and more distinguished man who gave way, even after Meyer had become aware of through a private report that he'd commissioned from one of his assistants of the full extent of Cotton's failures and the fraud, really, that this rested upon. He was reluctant to challenge Cotton and connived in covering up what was going on, and even after Cotton had died, praised him in his obituary in the American Journal of Psychiatry as an enormously important psychiatric pioneer whose death had been a great loss to patients and to the profession, which I find absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah. Is this story... This is a completely new story to me. Fascinating story, horrific story. There are lessons for today, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's this story, or these stories, how aware are the people who are practicing psychiatry today of what happened?
Well, I teach from time to time. I teach groups of psychiatric residents. And generally, I would say, unfortunately, the answer is that they're not very aware of these things. At the most, they will, like most members of American society, have heard of things like lobotomies,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps of insulin coma therapy, and be aware those things happened back in some sort of psychiatric dark ages. But even the history of those techniques really are things they're not aware of. And they're certainly not aware of the fact that in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, there was a veritable explosion of therapeutic experimentation on patients. I mean, Cotton's story is one particularly gripping one, but, for example, some of Cotton's associates, following up on his theories, tried to stimulate the immune system to fight off infections. And the way they did that was to inject horse serum into patients' spinal canals and give them meningitis. That, unfortunately, didn't seem to work. Other people had patients breathe an atmosphere of carbon dioxide, which, of course, would kill them if it continued long enough and was immensely frightening. There were experiments with heating patients up and experiments with cooling patients down as an effort to, in an effort to cure them. All sorts of things that were tried. And unfortunately, the profession doesn't seem terribly aware of it. We're, again, for the last 30 or 35 years, we've moved back into an era where rather simplistic biologically reductionist models of mental illness have come to the fore again, associated, of course, with the new drug treatments. And so psychiatrists have re-embraced the idea that the body's the source of the trouble, and it seems to me they might benefit from looking back at another era where, on the basis of rather flimsy scientific evidence, this kind of notion about mental illness was promulgated. It's a very, very dicey situation, I think.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Andrew Scull. He's Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Science Studies at the University of California, San Diego. He is the author most recently of Madhouse, A Tragic Tale of Megalomania and Modern Medicine. The book tells the story of an American psychiatrist early in the 20th century who believed he'd found the cause of mental illness, Dr. Henry Cotton. He thought mental illness was caused by hidden infection in the body, so to eliminate these infections, he performed surgeries on thousands of people. Many died. Others were maimed. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us with questions this afternoon at 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's go and talk with a listener now in Indiana on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. Listening to you talking about some of the I guess we call them regimens they tried to help these people and things I've read in the past, I've never come across why they tried particular things rather than, you know, why did they, you know, hit them with cabbage leaves rather than, you know, give them meningitis. What was the philosophical stuff behind all this? Some of it, at least to me now, seems rather crazy, and I thought there may be some, undercurrent chemical theory that was going on, or biochemical theory or something like that, that made them respond in certain ways to try certain efforts rather than others. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yes, I'd be glad to. There are lots of things one might say here. I think one thing to bear in mind, one of the things that lent plausibility to Cotton's own approach, was that in the early 20th century, scientists had in fact discovered the biological cause of a condition which had put quite a sizable number of people into mental hospitals. Somewhere between 5 and 20% of male admissions into mental hospitals in the early 20th century suffered from something called general paralysis of the insane, which produced both neurological symptoms and progressive paralysis, and usually delusions of grandeur and that sort of thing, very, very, very obvious psychiatric symptoms. And it turned out in the early 20th century that those people were actually suffering from tertiary syphilis. In other words, a syphilitic infection sometimes decades before had slunk underground and then attacked the central nervous system and rendered these people mad. So that was one source of infectious theories that seemed to bear things out. All sorts of other hypotheses, often highly speculative, we use to underpin these new approaches. For example, it was hypothesized in the early 1930s that you couldn't simultaneously have schizophrenia and epilepsy. That's actually a false claim, but it was believed by a number of people at the time. And based on that notion, people began to look for ways to artificially create epileptic fits as a way of curing the schizophrenia. And that was where metrazole, which was a particularly awful kind of convulsive therapy, came from. And subsequent to that, it's where ECT, or electroconvulsive therapy, came from, as people sought a more reliable and less frightful way of producing these grand mal seizures. Now, curiously enough, ECT, as you probably know, is the only one of these therapies that's still in use in psychiatry today, not for the treatment of schizophrenia, but for the treatment particularly of suicidal depression. So one I guess the other thing I'd like to say is that very often treatments in medicine and in psychiatry arise in a purely empirical way. In other words, we try something, it seems to work, and that's that. And then after the fact, we try to look for the mechanism that explains why that should work. The drug treatments that we see being used today for depression and for schizophrenia fall into this pathway. We don't know why those drugs work to the extent that they do. All sorts of hypotheses have been spread about it. And these days, we're all encouraged to believe that depression is simply faulty brain biochemistry or abnormalities in certain neurotransmitters. But in fact, the evidence for all that is not much stronger than the evidence for Cotton's theories, if I might say so. It's very slim. And in fact, these are largely empirical treatments, that is, treatments we use because we don't have anything better and because the data seem to suggest that they do some good for at least some of the patients they're used on.
Mm. So what are we to do if we or someone we love is in a situation where they're very severely depressed, suicidally depressed?
Well, of course, I should stress, I'm not a clinician, and it's not for me really to try to second-guess what should be done. What I would say based on my own reading in the literature is that there are a sizable number of patients for whom these drugs genuinely do seem to help and to make a difference, but there are others for whom they don't work, and there are very serious issues of side effects, that is, unwanted effects of all these classes of drugs. With the antipsychotics, for example, conditions like tardive dyskinesia, that is involuntary twitchings and gruntings and motions of the body, which are quite stigmatizing and which seem to reflect the brain damage which is caused by their pills themselves. As you may have seen in the last year or two, a growing controversy over whether with some patients antidepressants, rather than curing the depression, may worsen the suicidal impulse, and we're seeing the FDA getting quite anxious about this with respect to children and adolescents, and it may turn out that that spreads beyond those groups. So I'm not somebody, I want to stress, I'm not Tom Cruise, I'm not somebody who's running around saying, you know, no progress in psychiatry and all these things are simply toxic conspiracies against people. What I am saying is that we don't really know why they work. They don't work as well as the drug company propaganda would lead us to believe. And we should be much more cautious, I think, and much more skeptical. One of the morals of Cotton's tale for me is how gullible it turned out that fellow professionals were, family members were, even patients were. The desperation of people with diseases about which we can do very little often leads them into some very unfortunate situations. And again, we don't need to go only to psychiatry to find these things. I don't want psychiatry to be a sole whipping boy here. Think, for example, about patients with incurable cancers and the ways in which the desperate search for cure leads them in particular directions that often are not terribly desirable.
Hmm. We're running down on time. I've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. Next, we're going to go to a listener in Charleston on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on something that I think you've been getting at, which is, I mean, oftentimes when things like this, cases like this guy Cotton are presented, they're presented as cases in which there was a failure to apply the basic principles of science. And what it seems to me that you're saying now is something that I've felt for a long time, which is that sometimes the scientific method itself makes really huge mistakes, and not just sort of empirical ones, but also moral ones. I'm thinking of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, too. And I wish, it's just nice to hear this, because I don't think there's enough public discussion about science as something which produces amazing things, but then it also produces mistakes, which have drastic consequences, and that's all. I just wanted to hear the guests talk about.
Absolutely. I think that's a very, very important comment to make, and one or two of my reviewers, I think, have missed that and have tended to try to suggest this can be cotton's depredations can be assimilated to a kind of normal march of scientific progress model. I wish science moved quite as straightforwardly towards the truth as some of these people seem to believe. But in fact, it's a lot more complicated than that, and our notion that science is self-correcting, well, perhaps in the long run that may be true, but as Lord Keynes once famously said, in the long run we're all dead. And while, we don't have a better method of moving forward, I certainly am not anti-science, we do need to understand that, indeed, the scientific method is not, whatever that might be, is not foolproof, and professionals can indeed lead themselves astray as well as the rest of us astray, and it can take a long time for that to be sorted through.
Let's talk with a listener now in San Francisco, listening online. Good afternoon.
Yeah, afternoon, all. I was interested in this from another perspective, and this was, I'd heard that historically many of the institutions had been abused by heirs. In other words, if a large family had a large inheritance to split up, it was to the advantage of brothers or sisters to lock up one or two so that they wouldn't be eligible for the inheritances. And then in addition, and that was supposed to have been running maybe as high as 25% of the institutional space. Then a second large percentage was of pregnancies. Young girls, 15, 16-year-old, getting pregnant, they could be sent to a nunnery or off to their aunt, but in reality they were put into mental institutions and essentially lived away the rest of their lives as such. And then finally, the war veterans, those who do honestly end up with huge stresses if they don't end up in mental institutions tied with the VA that they were put in on the peacetime spending, so to speak, into mental institutions. So I'm just wondering if your guest has knowledge about the abuse.
Okay.
Well, let me respond a number of ways. Those fears of, for example, improper confinement of the sane first surfaced as long ago as the 18th century. Moral panics about that sort of thing have gone on for a very long time. Did such things ever happen? Yes, they did. Did they happen in very large numbers? I don't think so. That's not the source of the problem. Though what did happen over time, I'm convinced, and I've written at length about this, is that once you opened up mental hospitals, the boundaries surrounding what is and is not sufficiently severe mental illness to warrant institutionalization are very subject to social pressures and can move. So in the era of massive institutionalization, a substantial fraction of people who were scooped up and sent into the mental hospitals probably very easily could have subsisted on the outside. We, of course, live in an era where institutionalization is now distinctly unfashionable as a solution to mental illness. So we have the opposite situation going on. We have people who really have a very hard time coping in the outside world for whom there's no place in any kind of institution. So clearly those boundaries can shift, but were mental hospitals easily manipulated as sources to put away the inconvenient, that I rather doubt. And in fact, I don't think there's good historical evidence for that.
Okay. I want to thank the listeners this afternoon for joining us this afternoon with their questions. We're right here at the end of the time, Professor Scull. Before we go, though, can you briefly, just very briefly, talk about Phyllis Greenacre, a bright spot in the story?
Absolutely. If there is a hero or a heroine in this story, it's Phyllis Greenacre. Phyllis Greenacre was a young physician who was sent by Adolf Meyer to investigate Cotton's activities. This was an attempt to head off a more hostile outside investigation by the hospital authorities. And Greenacre was a very unusual person. She had paid her own way through medical school when her father refused to do so. She had got an appointment at Johns Hopkins, which was an extraordinary coup for anybody, let alone a woman, in 1916. She worked as, in many ways, Maya's right-hand person. She had children and insisted on continuing her career. So she was really a very, very extraordinary figure. And when she went to the hospital, she was greeted with a good deal of hostility. She was very persistent, very brave in the face of that. When she discovered that the social workers she'd been assigned to do the follow-ups on what had happened to the patients were themselves ex-patients, she realized that because they had no teeth, she herself did the follow-ups, often in very harrowing circumstances, and she exposed the whole thing. Basically, she wrote a report which definitively showed that Cotton's techniques, so far from working, were actually quite deadly. And that report was then suppressed by her superior, by Maya. She was betrayed by him. She was intimidated by Cotton. And she was finally betrayed by her husband and left Baltimore in the face of those betrayals. And Maya then kept her report under wraps. She herself was forced to rebuild a career, and in fact, I ended up speaking with her at some length. She was a very key informant for me and an absolutely remarkable woman, and she became one of the leading psychoanalysts in America, perhaps to distance herself as far as possible from this sort of biological psychiatry that she'd encountered at close hand.
There we have to leave it, I'm sorry to say. Fascinating story. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, Andrew Scull.
Thank you, Celeste. I've much enjoyed it.
Andrew Scull is the author most recently of Madhouse, A Tragic Tale of Megalomania and Modern Medicine. The book is published by Yale University Press. And that interview from August 9th of this year. Good afternoon. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 1:53 Central Time. Standing by with settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade, Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the board this afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The corn up about a penny and a half for the day. The beans were off anywhere between 2¾ and 6¾. We'll take a complete look at those numbers and how they settled in just a second. I want to remind you that the closing market report is coming up at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time today. That's just a few minutes away. We'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Greenfield Marketing out of Normal, Illinois. Now, the numbers from the board as they finished up. December contract in the wheat pit up a quarter of a cent today, 3.15. The high, the low at $3.10¼. The settlement price there at $3.11¾, and they were up a quarter. That despite the fact that the grain contracts were mostly lower at the Kansas City Board of Trade earlier. They were off as much as 10 cents at one point during the trade today. March futures in Chicago for the wheat, $3.30¾. The high, the low at $3.26½. A settlement price there at $3.28. They were down a quarter on the day. May contract at $3.39¾, the high, the low at $3.35½, and a settlement price at $3.36½, were off a half for the day. July contract, $3.47½, the high, the low at $3.43½, settlement price at $3.44¾, down a half. And September futures, a $3.53 high, low at $3.52½, a settlement price at $3.53, down a quarter of a cent. If you're keeping track of those spreads, you'll recognize fairly quickly that the numbers in Chicago were not nearly as low as the numbers at the Kansas City Board of Trade for the wheat for the day. December corn now in Chicago, $1.99½, pushing up towards that magical $2 level, hopefully going through that at some point in the coming weeks. Many farmers will be looking for that to happen. $1.96 was the low price today, and a settlement price at $1.96¾ were up 1¼. March futures, $2.13¼, the high, low at $2.09¾, settlement price at $2.10¾, up a penny for the day. And the May futures in the corn pit, $2.20¾, the high, the low at $2.17½. They settled at $2.18½, were up 1¼. July contract at $2.27½ high, low at $2.24½, settled at $2.25½, a penny and a half higher. September futures, $2.35½ the high, the low at $2.33. Settlement price at $2.33¾, were up 1½. And December contract for next year at $2.47½ on the high, the low at $2.43¾. December corn for 2006 settled at $2.45 a bushel. They were up a penny and three quarters on the day. December oat futures now, The high price at 169, low at 166 and a half, settled at 166 and three quarters. They were down a penny, and the March contract a penny and a half lower for the day at 172 and three quarters. November soybeans down 2 3/4, 597 and a half the high, the low at 88, settlement price at $5.90 and a quarter cents. That Nov contract in the nearby down 2 3/4 as it goes through expiration. January futures in the bean pit, effectively your lead option, a 604 high, low at 593, settlement price at 595, down 6 1/2 cents, and the March contract 609 and a half the high, the low at 598 and a half, a settlement price at 601. They were down 5 3/4. May contract in the bean pit 615 the high, the low at 604, settlement price at 605 and a half, down 6 3/4. And July futures $6.19 the high, the low at 609 and a half, settled 611 and three quarters, down 5 3/4. August soybean 618 the high, the low at 12 and a half, settled on that low, down a nickel for the day. And next year's November contract settled at 616. They were off 3 1/2 cents, the high at 21, the low at 15. December bean meal 180.20, down 150 today. And December bean oil off 23 at 22.51. That's a look at the numbers from the board. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, mixed day today. On the Merck November feeder cattle, 115.80, the high 115.40, the low, the final price 115.80, that up 75. January 114 even, the high, the low 113.05, the settlement 113.72 and a half, that up 75. March 112.10, the high 111.20, the low, the settlement 111.95, that up 77 and a half. December live cattle 91.35, the high 90.40, the low 91.07 and a half, the settlement that up 65. February 94.07 and a half, the high 93.32 and a half, the low, the settlement 93.95, that up 50. December lean hog 63.80, the high, the low 63.15, the settlement 63.35, that down 7 1/2. February 67.40, the high 66.50, the low, the settlement 66.80, that down 50. April 68.20, the high 67.65, the low 68.10, the settlement that unchanged. May lean hog 69.20, the high 69 even, the low 69.20, the settlement that up a nickel. And February pork bellies 88.50, the high 86.52 and a half, the low, the settlement 86.72 and a half, that down 152 and a half. The Dow is up a point at 10,687. The Nasdaq down 3 at 20.199, make that 22 even, and the S&P 500 down 2 at 1233.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson and Morris at 815-9000.